Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter. If you're listening to us on audio only, I'd appreciate you reviewing and rating the podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you're watching us on YouTube, of course, if you like what I do here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius and hit that bell for notifications. I have an announcement for Kung Fu Genius fans. Right now, for a limited time, you can get a one-month all-access trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine absolutely free. No strings attached after that free month either. Go to wcinewsstand.com to register in the upper right corner. Fill in your email and password and use the code KFGTRIAL to get 1 month free access to all the issues published from 2011 to the current issue. How cool is that? All the issues. And if you want that information again, it's in the description below. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of inch punching, lots of, hey, no money, no water. Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up?
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Practice all day like a genius.
Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
Yo, Sifu.
Here we go. Hey, this is episode 30.
30.
Who would have thought we would have made it this far, right?
No clue.
I thought after the first five episodes, we would have been canceled by the network. But luckily, they let us continue on.
Kept us on.
We had enough ratings.
I figured someone might cancel us.
That's right. And still, we're here. Still doing our thing. Super excited about it. So our 30th episode, we are doing another Ask Me Anything episode. But I think in the future, we are going to do a couple more. Like, people like those Bruce Lee conversation episodes that we did, where we did the Dan Lee conversation, and then I talked about it.
Got a couple.
Yeah, it was like about a 20-minute conversation. We squeezed about four episodes out of that, which is great. Because when you're a content provider, it's always like, oh, we need to fill an hour. It's not difficult for me to talk about Kung Fu for an hour, but there are a finite number of topics that, you know, we can talk about before we're constantly kind of treading the same ground. And there are a few other Bruce Lee recorded conversations out there. So there's a Ted Thomas interview, which he did, I believe that was on the set of Enter the Dragon.
Who's Ted Thomas?
Ted Thomas, I believe, was a reporter.
Yeah.
I believe. I have to double check. It's been a while. And yeah, I think he also wrote a book about Bruce Lee years later. So that's about
who hasn't wrote a book.
Who hasn't written a book, right? I haven't written a book about Bruce Lee yet. It's about a 14-minute interview with Bruce Lee. So we could probably get at least three episodes out of that.
Three or four.
Talking about that. Okay, let's analyze the first 3 minutes. Go.
Yeah.
And then there's also the Alex Ben Block interview. Alex Ben Block is a reporter. I believe I actually am friends with him on Facebook, and he did a interview with Bruce Lee over the phone, and that one is a little longer. I think it's a little longer than 20 minutes, and he wrote a book about Bruce Lee. I think it was called The Legend of Bruce Lee shortly after Bruce Lee died. And I think it was the first book to kind of mention like the use of cannabis and maybe to say some less than flattering things about Bruce Lee. So we can definitely do that interview. So yeah, some more Bruce Lee stuff.
What was the show he was on where he did the famous Be Water?
That was the Pierre Burton show.
Pierre Burton.
Yeah, the Pierre Burton show was actually a Canadian show that he apparently had done a bunch of episodes in different countries. And so he did a Hong Kong episode and Bruce Lee was his subject there. And it's interesting because that is the, at least as far as I know, the only video interview with Bruce Lee that survived. Because Bruce Lee did a whole bunch of interviews on Hong Kong television, right? And we have tons of photos of this, like with Robert Chua and all of these other very prominent variety shows that were on in Hong Kong at the time, as well as some just regular talk shows. He did an interview where yet Bob Wall and Chuck Norris were there with him around the time when he was shooting Way of the Dragon. And none of that stuff survived. And so
that's crazy.
From what I understand, because I've talked to a few Bruce Lee collectors, at that time, they didn't know Bruce Lee was going to be this huge phenom or whatever. So apparently, a lot of times they didn't even save the old reels because it was like, when that stuff showed, they weren't going to show it again. It's not like now where everything kind of lives on. You know, you can watch things whenever you want through YouTube or any other kind of apps where you get your TV and stuff like that on. But back then it was like when the thing showed, like you watched it and that was it. They didn't really have this idea that people are going to want to go back and revisit those interviews again and again, right? Mm. And so from what I understood, and I don't know if it's positive, I don't know anything about film and how that kind of stuff works back then. But from what I understood, they recorded over it or they reused it or they just, first of all, I don't even know if that's possible. I just heard that. Or they just got rid of it. And I think in the case of RTV, which was one of the stations, I think they actually had a fire. And so, yeah, in the 70s. And so that stuff like literally was destroyed. So that's why there's only a couple of the interviews. There's some, you can see like where Bruce is kicking and he breaks the boards and Brandon is there. But that was from an 8mm video that someone shot of the TV interview. So unfortunately, you know, the thing that I would love to see the most would be to see Bruce's interviews that he did in Cantonese.
Yeah.
Because he kind of famously pissed off some of the Chinese martial arts community, especially in, I think, in his very first interview he did, which is supposedly how Lao Dai Chun, his kind of perpetual tormentor, you know, how he got on his radar. And, you know, Bruce said some less than favorable things about Chinese
controversy
martial arts. Yeah.
Over here.
And so I would love to see that because I'm pretty sure that if we could go back and actually listen to what Bruce said, I'm pretty sure you would find it, especially from a 2021 lens, to be very non-controversial, right? But at that time, you know, the Chinese martial arts community was so conservative and so secretive and so set in their ways and so believed so many things about what they were able to do that you can imagine how that would have upset them. But he also did other, you know, TV interviews, you know, like the one with Bob Wall and Chuck Norris, I would love to have seen. The other one is like there was a surprise on a variety show. I believe it was for a charity because it had been like a big typhoon. And so they were raising money for families who had been affected in Hong Kong. And they had a huge cake. And out of the cake, I think they expected like some hot model to come out. And Bruce Lee came out, right? And it was like a big surprise, right? And we only have photos from that. And it's unfortunate because I would love to see those. No, there's not. It's all gone. And I have a friend of mine who's a Bruce Lee collector. And he is of the opinion that someone secretly owns it and doesn't want to release it. But he kind of believes that with everything. He's a great friend of mine, but he tends to believe that there's a bit of a conspiracy behind everything, right?
My guy, if you're watching this, stop sitting on this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? It's kind of weird that there is some other footage that exists from the set of Enter the Dragon. You know, most of the behind-the-scenes footage that we now can see, that is from Anna Capri, who played the head madame in Enter the Dragon, right? She had an 8mm camera. And then so a lot of that stuff you see, like where Bruce is doing that cha-cha bit or whatever, that was all from hers. Supposedly, there was a behind-the-scenes cameraman there who shot a behind-the-scenes film of Enter the Dragon. And I don't remember the exact story. It might have been in Paulie's book or something like that, but that stuff never really saw the light of day. So there is footage out there that, if it exists, there should be, like, good footage available still. But, you know, maybe some of the collectors out there who are listening might be able to you know, give some detail in terms of where some of that stuff might be or whether it even exists at all.
You know, there's a bartender at my job that said, man, I really like that video of Bruce Lee playing ping pong with the nunchucks.
Oh, my God.
And I said, dude, you know, that's so real. So cool, right?
you played him. You went with it.
No, I told him it was fake. He was like, no.
Yeah, you know
it's fake?
You know what's weird? Because I mean, I teach martial arts, so you have these kind of conversations all the time. And, you know, sometimes I have to be with people who are non-martial artists, which is kind of weird for me. It's like being a fish out of water, right? Because everyone around me, if they're not a Wing Chun person, they do martial arts. Like, I'm very comfortable talking to martial arts people, right? And then occasionally I have to go to things, because, you know, I got two kids. And occasionally I have to go to things like for parents. And like, you know, we live in New York, so parents are kind of pod people, right?
Yeah.
It's like when you're a kid, you're like, man, what's up with parents, right? I'm a parent, and I'll tell you what, I still think most parents are kind of pod people. I go to these things and I'm like, I don't have anything in common with any of these people, right? And so, of course, what kind of adult conversations come up? Oh, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm an accountant, or, you know, I count widgets for this company or whatever. It's like, what do? I teach martial arts. That's always what I say, and I usually just try to leave it at that.
Yeah.
Oh, what martial art do you teach? I teach something called Wing Chun. Oh, I never heard of it. Oh, well, it's the same thing that Bruce Lee did. Oh, yeah. Oh, man, I love when he does the nunchucks plays the ping pong or whatever, and it's like... That's not Bruce Lee. It's most likely a Korean actor. That was a Nokia commercial from the 2000s. It's CGI. What? That's not Bruce, but it's like he's wearing like the yellow tracks. It was a commercial, man. But it's just so weird because for them, they don't believe you saying like that piece of content didn't exist 15 years ago. Yeah. It's new.
Yeah.
But it's just weird to have to like, I don't know. You feel like you're kind of telling people that, you know, their hero doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's like, no, Bruce Lee was great. Like, that's not Bruce Lee. It's probably a Korean actor. Probably not even a Chinese actor. So, you know, it's kind of like, why do, but it looks so real. It's like, do you see the movie Forrest Gump? He also looked like a ping pong champ in there.
Yeah.
And that was with really old CGI, right? So, you know.
Man, what was you, Bruce Lai.
Yeah, Bruce Lai. So anyway, we got questions. What do we got?
I think we do have one or two, right? Let's set it off with Dr. Vortex Sophia. Or Dr. Vortex Sophia.
All right. Either way, you won't be able to say
it.
I can't wait until someone whose name is Dre pops up and you somehow manage to mess that name up. The same exact name.
This comes from Mr. Dre.
Mr. Dre.
Mr. Dry. Mr. Okay. Dear KFG. To follow up on Dre's question, where would you take a man born in 1983 to eat once he was done having mortal terror panic from the computerized world of 2021?
Did you mean 1893?
What did I say?
I think you said 1983.
And I literally think you meant flipped it.
1893. All right. Well, assuming it's Grandmaster Yip Man's birthday,
1893,
right? Got it. Where would I take him to eat?
No, wait. Dre told me to ask you, would you get stoned with Bruce if it was the only way to hang out with him?
What is up with these questions?
What is up with
the drugs?
I don't
know. Someone wrote this. I never told her this.
It's always drugs or like weird time machine things.
But I never said anything to her.
Yeah, but your name was mentioned in
there. I don't know why.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I wouldn't need to be stoned to meet Bruce Lee. You know why? You know why, Dre? Because I'm high on life.
Oh, dear.
Okay? Next question.
So you want to get stoned to hang out with
Bruce?
Next
question.
All right, Darkest Dragon. It is said that every school has their strength, specialty on something they do particularly well in comparison to other schools. What, in your opinion, is City WT's specialty?
Not telling students what Wing Chun has to be for them. All right, the one school, we're fighters. Everyone in the school is a fighter. And if you're not a fighter, you can't train here. Mm. And the other school is, we're in touch with our internals and the universe. And the other school, we do Wing Chun for combat. And the other school, you know, we do, I don't know, Wing Chun for mortal combat. And the other school, we do Wing Chun only for self-defense. And the other school, we do fitness Wing Chun or whatever. Like, for me, I think one of the secrets to the success of our school over the years and why we've lasted so long is that we teach Wing Chun in a very step-by-step manner, but what people decide they want Wing Chun to be in their lives, we let that be up to them. Because oftentimes when you have these schools that are like, oh, we're, you know, pure combat Wing Chun and everything's about fighting and blah, blah, blah. What you often see is that's the instructor's own neuroses being projected onto the students, all right? Because the instructor has something that they feel is maybe not necessarily lacking, but they just feel like they cannot handle it. if all of their students are not a bunch of hardcore fighters, because that's going to bring down the reputation of their school in their minds, right? So then what you see, like Krishnamurti always said, the instructor, the teacher, imposes their own burden on the students.
Interesting.
So normally when you see whatever the specialty of a school is, I think the subtext is that's the specific neuroses of that instructor. You know, so it's like if it's just all about self-defense, that might be because that's something that instructor is so important for them, right?
Hmm.
And if it's, this Wing Chun school actually trains up fighters to go into contests or whatever, okay? Well, that instructor probably has issues with the Wing Chun's lack of reputation among the sport community and wants to change that. So that's then why that school focuses on that, right? And then the problem is that school then, well, it's not a problem, it's the result. That school then becomes an echo chamber for that type of thinking. So all the guys who go to that one Wing Chun school that trains up people for fighting contests or whatever are going to then look at any other Wing Chun school that has a different area of focus as inferior or not doing it right or whatever. And I find that that's often the problem. I mean, look, if you want to go into fighting contests and you want to use Wing Chun, well, then you find the school that does that. And if you're more focused on self-defense, you find that. And if you're more focused on just learning it as an art, you do that. So at City Wing Chun, what do we focus on? Well, we teach people the classic art of Wing Chun, and we have definitely a focus on self-defense and definitely a focus on self-improvement, whether that's fitness or getting over your own ego or whatever that is. And we also teach it as an awesome kick-ass art. I don't specialize at all in training people to fight in the ring or fighting in sport contests or whatever. And if someone came to my school and wanted to learn that, I would tell them to go somewhere else because that's not what we do. So besides that, which is, it's not my interest. Like, I love watching sport fighting, but I'm not a sport fighter trainer. So besides that, I'll pretty much say our specialty is teaching Wing Chun, hopefully, without any my specific bias or neuroses imposed on the student. Like, if they want to come, and here's the crazy thing. Some people can come and learn at City Wing Chun, or I should say people could come to learn at City Wing Chun because they, dare I say, just like Wing Chun.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you can come and just learn it because you want to. There doesn't have to be this huge why of this style versus that style or we're really good at chain punching or whatever. It's like, no, you should have a place where you should feel comfortable to be able to develop yourself within that art. And I guess if there's a specialty, that would be ours.
All right. Let's go into Daniel Carrier. Hi, KFG. Since your beginnings as a Wing Chun teacher, have you noticed any significant changes in the type of students who practice Wing Chun? And what could today's students improve in the way they learn? Thanks. Love your podcast.
Great. That's super nice. Thank you for that great compliment. No, I would have to say that the types of students that we get are pretty much the same that we always got. We don't really have a kids program at City Wing Chun. We've taught kids from time to time. But we really focus on adults, and for the most part, I teach adult professionals. So our students tend to be kind of in their 30s and older, but we do still have a lot of students who've joined us in their 20s or late teens and have become instructors here and so on. But I specialize in teaching adults, and that's always kind of the crowd that I tended to get. I think like a lot of the younger guys tend to be a little unclear as to what exactly they want to do or what they want to train. You sometimes, like, a lot of those teenagers, they have that problem, especially nowadays with social media, but it was always that issue. Like, they'll do this, and then their friend says, oh, you know, you should do this instead, and then they'll go jump there, and well, there's also this thing, and you should do this, and you should do this. And so you tend to have a little bit of that insecurity about what you want to do when you're a little bit younger, whereas, like, the slightly older adults, by the time they come to us, they're like, yeah, this looks like something I want to do, and they generally tend to stick with it. And that has always been the same. I do have to say, though, that in the early days, because Siva Lang Ting put a lot of emphasis on the first generation of the school being a bunch of good fighters, because, you know, in his mind, it's always still the 1970s and 1980s, and we're all still fighting each other, and people are going to come to my school. And you know, the reason why there were a lot more challenge fights back in the days is because, you know, the Wing Chun people were a lot more tribal about their styles and their methods. And they also, pardon my French, all talk shit about each other. And so when you talk shit about each other, then you can expect that someone is going to come over and there's going to be some issues, right? So I don't spend time talking shit about other Wing Chun schools. I definitely have my opinions about different methods of Wing Chun. And I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, if you know, when the podcast is not running, you know, and you ask me as someone who's I'm very close to, you ask me what my opinion on, like, I can definitely tell you what I think about people. And I can definitely tell you what I think is not good Wing Chun and what I think is better Wing Chun. But I don't spend time talking about that publicly. And I don't, and that is not a big selling point of what I do, because I think a lot of Wing Chun schools, what they try to make their selling point is they go, look at how crappy the other Wing Chun styles are. Oh. They do this, 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 and this, and we do this, this, and this, which is so much better. And I always go, this is the worst advertisement for your school. You're basically saying the only reason why your Wing Chun is good is because everyone else is so bad. Mm. And that's not really a glowing endorsement of what you do, right? How about we actually have a realistic look in, or I should say a deep look into the other methods, and see what other styles of Wing Chun do that's really good, even if it's different from the way you do it. Like, there could be other ways of performing Bong Xiao and punching that are functional that might be at odds with the way you do it or teach it. That doesn't mean it's bad. It's different. And if you understand it, you can say, all right, well, they do it this way because their idea is like this. It has to work within the framework of how they fight. The way we do Bong Xiao might totally work for the way we fight, but might not work for another style if they use Wing Chun in a different way. And I think that having that kind of open of an attitude was not the case in the 70s and 80s. Mm. And so Sifu Liangting is still a product of that time. So when I started teaching, he was like, oh, you need to have a bunch of fighters, and you need to have a bunch of people just in case other people come into your school. And no one is going to come into your school if you don't have beef with other schools. Like, what? Why would people want to come into my school and start trouble? I'm not on the internet going and telling, oh, this guy sucks and that guy sucks or whatever, like some of my predecessors in WT did. I am too busy focusing on my students, and I'm too busy on focusing on my own training, and I'm too busy in building my school and my business to really give a crap what someone else does. And so many of the Wing Chun guys back in the day, including Sifu Liangting, were incredibly outwardly focused on what the other people were doing. It's like, you have this style that you really like. You like your lineage. You think it's good. You practice it. You give your students something of value, and you hopefully improve it. But you then still burn a lot of energy and a lot of heat worrying about what the other guy said about you, or how the other people teach things and do things or whatever. Like, who cares? Man. Even if someone else says something like, oh, I don't like what they do at City Wing Chun. Why would I even care about that? That person is saying it to an audience of people who are already learning from him. These are not people who are my students anyway.
Yeah.
Right? Like, who cares? Literally, who cares?
No one cares at the end of the day.
Yeah, and all martial arts people always talk about how martial arts gives you this very clear operating system of how to deal with conflict. And it's not just about fighting. It's also about applying this philosophy to your life. And then you look at the behavior of a lot of the Wing Chun Sifus and you realize this is anything but that. Mm-hmm. They allow all these other people to live in their own head. And they burn so much energy in there. Now, look, sometimes things have happened that made me upset with other Wing Chun Sifus because of certain behaviors or something like that. But you deal with it, you get over it, and you move forward, and you don't make that your talking point for the next 20 years. To circle back to this question, and it was kind of roundabout where I just went, Sifu Liangting is still a product of that time. So in his mind, I'm in New York. There are other Wing Chun people here. This is in the early 2000s. Of course, people are going to want to come. They're going to want to fight. They're going to want to challenge me or whatever. So my first generation of students, they need to be fighters. And so I definitely didn't only get fighters at the beginning. Like I mentioned about my first couple students were not the prime examples of fighters, but I did start like attracting a different group of students because I was trying to please my Qigong. And there were various periods in my teaching career, not just at the beginning, but even later in the late 2000s, even like maybe around the time you started or maybe before that, when I was still in Sifu Liangting's organization, where I still had that old programming on the hard drive. Mm-hmm. So I tended to attract some people who were a little thuggy. And so there were periods in the first phase of City Wing Chun, maybe even a little bit into the middle phase, depending on how long I teach. Hopefully it's still all the first phase. yeah. If I croak tomorrow, then it'll be the middle phase. If I teach for another 20 years, it'll still be my first phase, right? Yeah. There were periods where I looked around and the school was 80% people that I would not hang out with outside of the school. They were all kind of jocks and kind of dicks and kind of aggressive. I realized that I was kind of going in a wrong way. And I wasn't, what I was doing is I was teaching people who are already kind of tough how to fight using Wing Chun, as opposed to teaching it to people who really need it. Namely, people who don't walk in off the street ready to go and ready to fight. So, but for the most part, and again, when I say this, these are ebbs and flows. These are not like, oh, for 2 years, City Wing Chun was nothing but a bunch of mouth-breathing idiots. You know what I mean? And also, these guys were not idiots. I just tended to have people who turn the atmosphere of City Wing Chun in certain phases. This is already now 10 years ago, 11 years ago. It's not that way anymore. But it was a little bit like a dude's locker room sometimes.
Yeah.
And so I, at some point, you know, some of those students left and I didn't fight for them to stay. I was like, okay, I can start a new phase. And but for the most part, we teach adult professionals and very cosmopolitan and very international and all sorts of different backgrounds. And I love coming to the school and seeing all the different types of students we teach. And one of our assistants, Marlon,
yeah.
I saw him over the weekend. And Tom, the bodybuilder, you know,
yeah.
another type of student we have. He drove us back home. And then, you know, Marlon said to me, he says, man, if it wasn't for Wing Chun, all of the people I meet at the school, these would never be people that I would otherwise encounter in my circle.
Yeah.
And he was so grateful for the school because he has a chance to meet people that he otherwise wouldn't meet. And just for that alone, just feels so much richer for the experience. So that's how it is.
Two great dudes you just mentioned.
Yep.
By the way. Wow. Okay. The Bobinator. Considering you said in a podcast episode that you've practiced Taekwondo, do you find mixing Wing Chun with TKD go well? Also, any chance you will invite a TKD instructor, master, to join in your podcast?
That's an interesting question. No, certainly don't mix it. The fighting concepts could not be more divergent between Taekwondo and Wing Chun. Taekwondo being mostly long range, mostly legs, Wing Chun being mostly close range, mostly hands, right? Which would sound like that they're a perfect complement, right? You have the long range kicks from one and then the close range punches from the other. But when you're talking about combat, which is very fast and all combat is close range, you're usually out of that kicking range very fast. You're in the punch and clinch range so fast, faster than you can say roundhouse kick. So the problem is that if you throw a roundhouse kick, your body's sideways. And when your opponent rushes you and you want to use Wing Chun, you need a squared on position. So look, it's not impossible to mix these things, okay? Mm-hmm. I just wouldn't say that they're the most compatible. I certainly don't mix them. But what do? You're one of my students. You know, when we're practicing kick defense,
yeah.
What do? I put the shin pads on and I give you guys those kicks so that you can actually practice defending kicks against me. I'm a Taekwondo black belt, right? So we use it. I use it so I can teach my students better how to fight against long range kicks and they have an idea of what that feels like. But in my opinion, and look, I'm sure there are people out there who successfully mix Wing Chun and Taekwondo, and I'm not trying to dump on what they do or whatever. But in terms of the Wing Chun that I learned and the Wing Chun that I understand, side-on bladed position long-range kicks don't really combine well with the squared-on using both arms close-range punching tactics that we use in Wing Chun. So no, I actually don't. And so I'm the Kung Fu genius. I'm not the Taekwondo genius. You know, when we have guests, they're usually Bruce Lee-related guests. Or I just did a couple episodes with Kenneth Jay, which will be kind of like mini episodes. He's a sport physiologist. He also trains MMA fighters. And so if it's not a Jeet Kune Do person or a Wing Chun person, I don't think our audience wants me to interview some Taekwondo guy. I think we would kind of lose viewers on that one. It's hard to even get the right guest that the audience knows because we have a relatively eclectic group, but I think I could bring the top Taekwondo champion here, and I think most of our audience wouldn't know who that was.
What was the guy from the Game of Death movie comes to mind?
Jihan Jay. He's actually a Hapkido guy.
Hapkido.
Yeah, Hapkido, okay. Right?
And then, no.
And, yeah, so Jihan Jay was the second guy that Bruce Lee fought in the original Game of Death footage, the Korean master, and
the gold belt.
The gold belt, yes. And I had the opportunity to meet him 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I have the photo in my Chum Q book at the beginning. Yeah, Tian Jie was actually the teacher of Angela Mao. Mm-hmm. Angela Mao, when she started making movies for Golden Harvest in the early 70s, she came from a Chinese opera background in Taiwan. That's why, very similar to Jackie Chan, and that's why she had all that kicks and the acrobatic stuff.
Love Angela Mao.
But she never actually had formal martial arts training, because the opera training is Chinese opera. It's not, you're not learning a specific style of martial arts, right? So she made a movie called Hapkido for Golden Harvest, and Jian Jie is in that movie. And he taught her Hapkido for that film. So that means that he is actually her only, Jian Jie is her only formal martial arts teacher. Now, the interesting thing is, like, so they made this movie, right? And then, you know, Bruce ends up using Angela in Enter the Dragon in that flashback scene as his sister. And he ends up using Jian Jie in Game of Death for the second fight scene. Flash forward a number of years later, I believe Jian Jie had ended up, he moved to New Jersey.
Right.
He now lives, I think, out in Arizona or New Mexico or something like that. But I believe he was living in New Jersey for a while, maybe Princeton area, something like that. And Angela, in the mid-90s, moved to Bayside, Queens, and opened a restaurant.
Right.
So they were literally a state apart for, like, decades.
Yeah.
And they didn't even know that they were so close to each other. Because Angela regards Jian Jie as her sifu. Because he's the one who actually taught her formal martial arts. I believe he even awarded her a black belt with a certain Dan level just based on the training they had done in that short time, because she was so excellent. And he said that she is of the level of a, you know, a black belt holder of a second or third Dan. I don't remember what it is. And so, my good friend Hector Martinez, who does the opening, you know, he's unstoppable, unbeatable, the guy who does that, right? That's my good friend Hector. He's a Bruce Lee collector. And he somehow got in touch with Jian Jie or Jian Jie's people and then arranged for us to bring him to see Angela. So it was their first reunion since the 1970s.
Oh, that's lit.
And, no, it was crazy. And she was super excited. And, you know, Angela doesn't really speak English that well. And obviously she speaks Mandarin. She's from Taiwan, but she also speaks Cantonese because she lived in Hong Kong for a number of years. And so there I was at the table with Angela Mao and Jian Jie. And I'm just sitting there, you know, as a child. Like, I grew up watching both of the, well, you know, Jian Jie in Game of Death and Angela in Enter the Dragon, plus the other movies, Lady Whirlwind Tournament, all the other films I had seen. And I was the Cantonese translator. And it was so weird because it was like the culmination of, like, me making all these decisions to basically not grow up and become a proper adult, and just do what I've loved to do since I was a child. And there I was, like, you know, he would say some things in English and then I would translate it into Cantonese, and she would say some stuff and I would translate to him in English. And I just, there was a moment where I just had to kind of stop for a moment and realize, like, this guy fought Bruce Lee. She's Bruce Lee's sister in Enter the Dragon. Here I am sitting at a table, eating noodles, translating in Chinese. And, like, I was a child.
You're the middleman right there.
I'm the middleman. You have to realize those movies were already 15 years old when I saw them as a child. Yeah. And now it's like all these years later. Jian Jie's obviously a bit aged at this point. And Angela's still great.
So she's dope.
She's in great shape. Yeah. So that was pretty wild, right? So anyway.
Oh, man. All right. Let's move right along, man. That was really cool. Thanks, Bobinator. All right, next up we got Dryzen. Hey, Sifu Alex Richter, always the victor.
What?
Oh, now I feel like Dryzen is trying to butter me up a little bit.
What do you mean?
Because the last two questions were absolute dumpster fires.
Absolutely.
Dumpster fires.
Didn't I tell you? You need to screen the questions much better.
We've been screening.
We have so many fans out there that are asking legit. How come you scratch every time I press you on Dryzen? You suddenly scratch in your upper lip. You feel like, you look like you're a little uncomfortable.
It gets a bit squirrely, doesn't it?
He gets a bit squirrely, right?
What?
I have the impression, as I've told on squirrely. The last two episodes, that you and Dryzen, there's some kind of weird connection there.
How so?
Because sometimes I'll tell you, hey, I'm not going to answer that question. But every time I tell you I don't want to answer one of the Dryzen questions, you always push back a little bit like you're defending.
I didn't even ask the question yet.
Yeah, but I have a feeling it's going to be another dumpster fire. All right, go ahead. Just go ahead and ask. Let's see what it is this time.
I didn't even finish reading the question.
Let's do it.
I don't
Let's do it.
I don't know the question.
Okay.
But let me
You picked it somehow. You don't. You're supposed to be the question. How do you
honestly,
not know the question?
I just saw
Dryson and said, yeah, definitely.
I just got to ask, right? Am I going to have to get the sound effects out for this question?
Most likely. All right, let's go.
I don't know.
Let's go.
Well, all right. He asked, hey, Sifu Alex Richter, always the victor. Hypothetical question for you.
Another hypothetical question.
Hypotheticals.
Yeah. All right, let's go. Let's go.
If you were on your way to your school on the NYC subway and the train randomly got stuck inside the tunnel, because that never happens, for about an hour.
Okay.
You finally get out of the train station and you notice you're in 1960s Hong Kong.
It's always a time machine question with Dryson. It's always a time machine question.
I don't think so.
It's as if he's just filling a Mad Libs.
Mad Libs.
Yes. All right, let's go.
So,
1960s Hong Kong.
Right.
Okay.
And you.
Which I don't think they actually had the MTR back then. They might have. I don't think they actually had the MTR.
You get out.
Okay, time machine.
You get out.
I get out. I'm on the street.
You're looking around.
Uh huh.
But you just look odd.
I look odd?
Yeah, you just look odd.
Because I'm wearing 2021 clothing in the 60s Hong Kong.
You look out of place.
All right.
Then all of a sudden.
Although if I was dressed like most people in Brooklyn. As a hipster, I might actually fit in well in the 60s.
So. Yeah,
perhaps. You're right.
Yeah, I got the beard, the tight pants.
You got the hair.
Hipster. So, yeah, and you all of a sudden, you just find yourself getting handcuffed by Tong Sung. And you're like, yo, what? And he's just like, yo, don't resist.
You know how I know this is... That there's some connection.
You look back. No. You see dude in a white suit.
You know how I know there's some connection between you and this Dryson who keeps asking questions? Because for the last 2 minutes, you haven't even read the question off the screen. You've literally been acting it out. You have been acting out the question.
I'm reading it right here.
You're not reading it. You're literally acting it out in front of me.
You are incapable of remembering a 2-minute sentence, and yet here you are.
Yeah, everyone knows.
It's right here.
You famously don't even remember the intro. Yet Dryson's question, without it's looking, right. You can act it out like he's a Shakespeare.
All I know is it says right here. You look back, you see the white suit. And then you look at his face and his Tong Sung, and you look to the side, his right, and you see Yip Man just like.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Nodding his head. Happy that I'm arrested.
For some reason. What would you say in that moment to get out of the handcuffs?
Yamo gao choa. And that's it. Man, you in these weird hypothetical questions. Oh, sorry, Dryson in these
what
weird hypotheticals.
What does Yamo Gao Choa mean?
It kind of means like, what the hell? And the fact that some white dude... The fact that some white dude in the 1960s would say something like so colloquial, so Cantonese,
ooh.
They would probably be like, wait, what's going on here? Something's going on. This isn't a normal Guaylo. This isn't a normal whitey here.
Right.
And then I could say, hey, look, I know your future. All right, I would tell Tang Sang, who spoke English, by the way. I know your future, man. You got to get out of Hong Kong.
He spoke English?
Yeah, he spoke English. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
he never knew that.
He knew my Sifu, and they spoke English. He was quite. Wow. I don't know what his level of education was, but he was quite intelligent. I mean, look, you don't get to that level.
He knew my Sigong Kernspeck.
Yeah, they were very close. He had gone and seen him a bunch of times. He spoke English. Sifu always says he was very refined in his manner of speak. He was, in certain ways, he was very European. He liked European fine wines. He liked Swiss watches. He liked Western suits. He had very Western sensibility about him, but he was also obviously very Chinese, loved Chinese martial arts. And
how many white suits you think he owned?
I don't know. He must have had all the white suits, right? Because in the 60s, everyone wore dark color suits, right? And you would always see Tang Sang wearing a white color, like Scarface up in here, right?
Yeah, with a red shirt.
It's amazing.
No tie.
And you know what's interesting? I had a student a number of years ago, a Chinese student, who told me about Tang Sang. And he said Tang Sang was affectionately his uncle. But not uncle by relation, but like, you know, it's normal when you're growing up in a Chinese family, friends of your parents, you also maybe call them uncle. It's actually not
Spanish
too different.
Spanish community.
Spanish same, being Cuban. The number of cousins I have who are not even remotely blood related to me, they're only the kids of family friends, yes, right? But yes, they're all cousins for yes, us, right?
That's your uncle. That's your Theo.
Yeah. So my student, when he was young in the early 70s, went on a trip with his family to the Philippines. And it was like an organized tour, like a Chinese tour, because his family is from Hong Kong. Wow. And Tang Sung happened to be on this tour. He was also on vacation with his family. And so he said he had met like Tang Sung's kids and the wife and everything like that. And he said, you know, they would go on this tour, and I don't know where they went to the, I don't know where they were going at that time, somewhere in the Philippines. And he says that, you know, when they would go out and eat, there was a small tour group. And they would go out to some restaurant, like some nice Japanese restaurant or some nice fancy restaurant somewhere in the Philippines. And Tang Sung would pay for everyone. He would just whip out the fat stacks and pay all those things, right?
Of course, you're a kid. You remember stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so that was in the early 70s. So that would be shortly before. So Tang Sung, and I really want to do a deep dive in Tang Sung. Perhaps what I'll do is I'll do a... I want to do a series called like The Ghosts of Hong Kong and talk about all this old stuff. But this wouldn't be a normal podcast setup. This would be like I would write it out, you know what I mean, and make sure that I got all the facts and dates and everything correctly. And then I would do maybe like an hour and tell some of these stories.
Touch on
right?
Dirty Ho.
Jeez. And that's a great movie, by the way. And they just released it, I think, on Blu-ray as well. Yeah, yeah. So, unfortunate title. Great movie, though. Yeah. you know, maybe tell, like, kind of like a Dan Carlin hardcore history where I just, like, do a deep dive and tell this stuff. And I'll probably do something like that for our Patreon supporters soon, and then maybe I'll do a light version for the regular podcast.
Okay.
Because, you know, Hong Kong had a massive corruption problem through the 50s and 60s and certainly into the 70s. I mean, they arguably always had it. They arguably still have it. There were no internal affairs for the Hong Kong police. So corruption was pretty rampant, especially in bribery, essentially. Local gangsters who ran certain types of businesses, whether it was brothels or they just did the normal extortion, you know, like you have a business in my district.
Walking through Hong Kong streets and they're like, hey, hey.
Yeah, you have a business in their area, you got to pay that person a protection fee. Well, those guys, the biggest gangsters at that time were the cops because they were a little bit on top where the triads would take their extortion money fees that they got from all the businesses. And then they would pay a cut to these cops to look the other way. So it was actually the cops at the top that were earning the most amount of money. And that's why by the late 60s, you had these so-called millionaire cops like Loi Lok and Tang Sung and many of these, right? And this became a big issue because these guys had multiple fat houses in Hong Kong. And they're police detectives, and they're basically millionaires, right? Some of them, like Loi Lok, was more directly involved in the heroin trade, I believe. Oddly enough, Loi Lok had a connection to another Chinese, very much like the movie Dirty Ho, which has an unfortunate title. Great movie, unfortunate title. There was a very famous heroin dealer in Hong Kong who was very dangerous, very top of the food chain. Unfortunately, also had a very unfortunate nickname when you said it in English. He was Limpy Ho. Oh, but actually, Ho is pronounced, I believe, well, actually, I might be wrong. It's either, whenever you see the Chinese surname Ho, it's either, it can be Ho, can also be Ho.
Ho.
But I think he might actually be Ho. I think he might actually be Ho. Anyway, he was called that because when he first started like his illegal criminal career, he had apparently been running his, you know, he started off with like a little stall where he was selling some stuff, and he had it in an area where he wasn't protected, and they busted his leg.
Ah.
And so he always had it for the rest of his life. He had a limp.
Limpy Ho.
And then so he became Limpy Ho, unfortunately, right? And by the way, he had a house in Kowloon Tong, not too far from Bruce Lee's. And he was top of the food chain, and Loi Lok, who was one of these millionaire cops, and Limpy Ho, apparently, they had a connection there. And so Tang Sung, from what I understood, obviously he was a Wing Chun instructor and a huge martial arts fanatic, and he was also one of Yip Man's private students. I don't believe that Tang Sung had much connection to like heroin smuggling and stuff like that. I think he was just kind of a collecting bribe money from the local guys. I don't think, because I never heard anything about him being part of like those heroin rings and stuff like that. I think he was just collecting his fees, right? And corruption was so rampant in Hong Kong that it wasn't just in the police. It was like everywhere. Like if you had a sick relative in a public hospital, you know, they would get a very simple room. And so if you wanted your uncle who is in this public hospital to get like a nice pillow, you pay the nurse. And maybe you want your uncle to have a better room, or you want your uncle to get more pain meds than he should otherwise get, you literally paid the nurse. But that was really Hong Kong before the early 70s. It was really like that. That's why when people go, well, how come it seems that they didn't really test for illicit drugs in Bruce Lee's autopsy? First of all, I've read his autopsy report like 50 times, and from what I can tell, because I just got another copy of it.
Is it like 5-10 pages? Right?
It doesn't look like they actually checked for anything. Like, they knew he had cannabis and they knew he had equagesic in his system, so it was like, okay, just check for those two things. That's kind of the impression you got. Because everything else, they check for metals and poisons, but it doesn't actually say whether... So when people say, oh, they didn't find any cocaine in his system, it's like, well, you actually don't know that, bro, because it actually does not say at all, even on his toxicology report. Actually, there's no mention of those drugs being tested. Now, of course, I'm not trying to wear a tinfoil hat or anything like that, but in pre-1974 Hong Kong, you could have easily paid someone. I mean, look, you could pay a nurse at a public hospital in Hong Kong to give your uncle better pillows and better pain meds. And that was just a matter of putting some cash in the nurse's pocket. You could certainly pay, if you were Raymond Chow, you could certainly pay a coroner to just check certain drugs. And I'm not saying that that's what happened. And I'm not saying, because people say, oh, the Kung Fu Genius said that. I'm not saying that. But
my
I'm just saying.
My dad was the coroner.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, that was
he
not.
He would never take a bribe.
Without wearing a tinfoil hat and getting all conspiratorial, that was quite possible. And in fact, even the fire department, all right, they would show up. Your house is on fire in Hong Kong. Fire department shows up. You're out. Ah, my house is on fire. They go there and they look at you. And they're waiting. You know what they're waiting for? They're waiting for you to pay them. And then they'll put your house out. They will extinguish the fire. There was a famous saying in Hong Kong in the 60s, which was, mo qin mo shui, which is no money, no water. Because that's what the firemen told you. So Hong Kong, which is a very progressive and modern and Western society in Asia, still had this rampant corruption. So it wasn't just the cops. It wasn't just the triads. It was like the firemen. You needed to pay them to put out the fire. The nurse, you needed to pay her to get a better bed. That was rampant.
All around.
So at some point in the late 60s, they were like, man, this is getting a little bit too much. And we're going to have to start fighting corruption in the police ranks and elsewhere.
I got to pay my grandma for a sandwich.
In 1969, Tang Sung retired from the police force. He had enough money where it didn't matter. But he retired relatively suddenly in 1969. He could not have been older than me right now. So a cop in his 40s. Up and retires with enough money to live comfortably for the rest of his life. And he retired because, from what I heard, you know, in 1969, there were already rumblings that they wanted to create some kind of anti-corruption unit and go after these cops who were doing these things. And then in the early 70s, Peter Godber, who was, I believe, the chief of police, a Brit, because at that time it was the Hong Kong Royal Police. It was still under the Britain at that time. Right. So all the top chiefs were all British dudes. And for the longest time, they expected that the corruption that was rampant in the Hong Kong police force was only rampant at the Chinese level and maybe the level of like lieutenants and stuff. They didn't think that corruption actually went all the way to the top.
Yeah.
And then they found out, so Peter Godber, who is like, you know, some British, he was like the chief of the Hong Kong police.
For a sec, the fact that his last name was Godber,
says everything, right? He makes a deposit because he's going to retire. And I believe, and I have to go back, and that's why, like, when I do the Ghosts of Hong Kong and talk about these old stories, I'm going to go back through my notes and then, you know, like right now I'm just going off what I remember. So it's possible that I might make a couple mistakes with dates or timelines or something like that. But when I go ahead and do it, I mean, I have reams and reams of research and books and stuff in my house. I would really want to talk about this stuff. He made a deposit. I think he was going to retire and go to Canada. And he made some deposit in like a ridiculous amount. It was so much money that the bank in Canada was like, well, why is a police detective from Hong Kong who's retiring have this much money? So that bank called like some government official in Hong Kong and was like, how come this police guy is, let's say it was $1 million US or something ridiculous in 72, 73. And they then realized that all these local lieutenants and chief inspectors that were collecting all these money, all the Tang Sangs and all those guys who were living fat, they were also still paying it forward up to the top. And actually, the British officials were also at the very top of that. And when they started to investigate Peter Godber, they found ledgers. And the ledgers, they said, were more accurate than the Hong Kong Internal Revenue Service in terms of what businesses were making what. They said that Peter Godber had ledgers on exactly how much money all the brothels were making, exactly how much money all of these different businesses were making, that even the Hong Kong government didn't have anything like that. They said that, and because they had like a very well-oiled machine. And finally, when they realized that this corruption had even gone to the almighty untouchable Brits, and because they thought it was just a Chinese problem,
right,
which is already, well, if it's just a Chinese problem, it's Hong Kong. Why don't you do something about it? No, it wasn't until the Brits got tarnished in this thing that they said, okay, enough is enough.
Yeah.
And then they formed the Independent Commission Against Corruption. Sometimes I say Independent Council Against Corruption. It's Independent Commission Against Corruption. And the ICAC, which is like an independent agency.
ICAC.
Yeah, ICAC, right? And you know, of course, there have also been some controversy since ICAC came out. In the 90s, there was a movie, it was called ICAC, I Corrupt All Cops. And so there's been a lot of backlash on that stuff too. And so anyway, they started to fight corruption and they started to go after all these people like Loy Lok and Tang Sang. Now that started in 1974. Tang Sang had already been retired for 5 years. He was still living in Hong Kong. And by 1976, only 2 years after the ICAC was formed, they came after Tang Sang. And they arrested him and he paid his bail. I believe it was something like the equivalent of $100,000 at that time. He paid it in cash. and then he was supposed to have a court hearing. To come back because he was charged with some emoluments thing and having like money above that's not commensurate to the station of being a police inspector or something like that.
Yeah.
And he got on a boat and went to Taiwan and never came back. And so that was that story there. So in this super long explanation, radar.
No one's seen him since.
To come to the only question that Dreisen asked, which I would even entertain at all. All right. I would tell Tang Sang, yo, you got to get out of Hong Kong earlier.
Oh, okay.
You got to get out of Hong Kong before 74. Just get out.
And have him like,
just take all your money.
You just in the handcuffs like.
Yeah. You got to take all your money. You got to get out. How would you convince him? I would name drop some people that he his one student. I know this guy. You know what I mean? And I would basically just tell him the future. Bruce Lee's going to die in 1973 in Betty Ting Pei's apartment. And he'd be like, whatever, Betty Ting Pei. She's so B-list. Why would he be with her?
She's so B-list. Ouch.
Yeah. So, Tang Sang ends up dying in 1986, 1987, early 87, I think. And so, yeah. So I would curry favor with them by telling them things.
And you get out the handcuffs.
Yeah, I would tell Grandma Shia, man, stop smoking, man. I would tell him, you smoke Camels unfiltered, right? And he'd be like, stop smoking.
He'd be like,
bad for your health.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, man. I can't wait for that that thing to come out, the ghosts.
Ghosts of Hong Kong.
Yeah.
It'd probably be a multi-part series. Yeah, I got a lot to talk about that. Yeah, because I wanted to write a book about Tang Sang for the longest time. The problem was every time there was stuff that I needed to find out, like some in-depth stuff, and I could never find his family, and I just kept running. He's a fascinating character, and I would love to know more about him, but his family, they're not going to talk, and you can't even find them. They're all ghosts. Mm. So I was always like 5 years too late. I would meet someone like, oh, yeah, I just saw Tang Sang Sung 5 years ago. Do you know where he is? No. It was always 5 years too late. Someone I always talked to had seen someone in the family or seen someone you 5 years before then.
Not 5 minutes. Dope. All right, moving right along. Thanks, Dryzen. Dryzen?
Yeah, thanks.
Appreciate that question.
Yeah.
Next up, we...
narcissist.
Yeah, no, full of himself.
Yeah. Ooh, what? We got Carlos Estrella. How much does your prior TKD and JKD training influence your Wing Chun, Sifu Alex? Specifically, do you find yourself chambering Wing Chun kicks or using more of a bladed JKD stance when doing WT sparring? Also, how much BJJ creeps in? Mm-hmm. Finally, in your mind, does it all become your Wing Chun or is it something else?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a multi-layered question. Mm-hmm. Well, to answer that last part, I always think it's funny because it's sometimes, not always, but it's sometimes the position of people who are absolute hacks in martial art to not really get good at it, at something. Like they do, like these people who, they'll go to a weekend Wing Chun seminar and then the next weekend they go to a weekend Jeet Kune Do seminar and then they're basically collecting certificates to kind of mix these things willy-nilly and do it their own way, because the moment you say, well, this is my expression of Wing Chun, the kind of people, and I'm not, look, and I'm not saying they're legitimate. Look, every instructor who teaches Wing Chun and does it for any period of time essentially does their own take on the art, because no one does the art exactly as it is. Everyone does the art as they themselves are. No one does the art as it is.
That's deep.
All right? Nugget. But so anybody who's accomplished in any martial art could say something like, well, I mean, this is my expression of, be it Wing Chun or Jeet Kune Do or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or whatever martial art, right? But that is a position should only go to people who've actually gone through that stuff and can legitimately say that because they've trained it really hard and they've internalized it. And then, of course, it becomes their own. The problem is that people who are nowhere near that level of accomplishment, they hijack that argument to say, well, this is my expression of Wing Chun, because they haven't actually gone through and really learned a style of Wing Chun. They've learned 8 different styles on 8 different weekends.
They barely dipped their nuts.
Yeah, they barely dipped their nuts in the style, as I like to say, right? And so... And so what they do is they're not really accomplished. They have some vague idea. And so what they do is they want to be an instructor. They want to be beyond reproach. So what do? You say, well, this is my interpretation. This is my version of Wing Chun. Because what they do is they use that argument to be beyond criticism if they do something that is not orthodox or not within the accepted norms of that style. Because then they use that as a card to basically say, you cannot criticize me because I am doing... Alex Richter Wing Chun and not Leung Teng Wing Chun, right? And so the problem with that last part is that it can be used by legitimate martial arts, martial artists. You know, like in the Gracie family, you have many different sub-styles, right? Henzo has his own way of doing things, which is a little bit different from like how Henner does it, for example, right? And but these are people who are super accomplished in those arts. And they're essentially doing the same art with a slightly different flavor. And that flavor is usually the personality of the person teaching it, right? So like Henzo and his brother Half, they're very aggressive, not like as people, but like in their style. So their jujitsu is very go forward, go for the attack, go for the submission. This is like the John Donahue style, like Magno and stuff, right?
Yeah.
The Helio side tended to be a little bit more passive, just kind of hold on, let the guy get tired, let the guy make a mistake, and when there's an opportunity, then you go for it, right? Two slightly different schools of thought in the same martial art, but what is the main difference? The main difference is in the character of the person teaching it, right? So that is, I think, when you earn the right to say this is so-and-so way of doing it or the other way of doing it, right? You have to internalize the art enough to be able to say that. You can't be one of these weekend warriors collecting certificates every weekend and say, well, this is my Wing Chun style, this is my interpretation of it, and therefore you cannot criticize me, right? So that's why, to get to that last part, every time I hear someone like, oh, is it all just your Wing Chun? I go, well, it might be, but I hopefully don't want to be lumped in with the weekend warrior guys collecting certificates, right? Because that is also, unfortunately, the same position of people who are absolute hacks in martial arts, okay? So that's why I always like, I would like maybe for our audience members that when you hear someone going like, well, this is my Wing Chun or this is my way of doing it, you ask yourself, is this person legitimately accomplished in this martial art? Or is this guy someone who just barely skims his balls into a style and then goes on to the next one and doesn't want to be criticized? So therefore, uses this as a way out.
Mm.
And that is what a lot of the Chinese people thought Bruce Lee was doing with Jeet Kune Do. Because a lot of the traditional Chinese martial artists didn't understand that Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do was a legitimate philosophy and a legitimate break in his mind from what he was doing, from what he had done before. Most of the other Wing Chun guys in Hong Kong thought, oh, well, he never learned Wing Chun. So he's just creating his own style so you cannot criticize him because it's his own style. That is actually the position of many of the very conservative Wing Chun guys in Hong Kong who literally don't understand anything about Bruce Lee at all. They look at him only as a rebel of the Wing Chun family who broke away. So they can only see that through their lens. In order to see it through their lens, they have to justify it. Why would Bruce break away from the Wing Chun style? Well, obviously because he hadn't learned it. And if you create your own style, you are the king and you're beyond reproach in terms no one can tell you you're wrong. And that is literally what some people in Hong Kong will tell you. That is why Bruce Lee created you. I have had old Chinese sifus tell that to my face. I've studied Bruce Lee since I was 8 years old. Read all of his stuff. Like, I understand to the best of my ability. Or I should say, I have an understanding, which I believe somewhat mirrors what Bruce at least would want me to think his reason for Jeet Kune Do was. And you have Chinese people in Hong Kong who will just tell you because they're Chinese and you're not. Bruce Lee created his own style because he couldn't finish learning the Wing Chun system and he didn't want anyone to criticize him, so he created his own style. And they will tell you that as if that is the mic drop and there's no nuance. That is the end of the story right there.
Hmm.
Okay? And anyone who knows anything about Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do, especially in his notes, knows how uneasy Bruce was about even naming his philosophy, because then he meant the moment you name something, you have institutionalized it. And it was that institutionalization that he was rallying against. So he kind of understood the pickle that he put himself in by creating something which was like, you know, Jeet Kune Do, as he said, was just the name he gave to his ignorance. And he wanted to use it as a developmental tool. But it has become an established style over time. And he perhaps was the one who didn't want that, but he still did create a name for it, right? But someone who's uneasy with even creating a name for their style because it's essentially a philosophical idea is certainly not the guy who created that because they wanted to be the grandmaster of their own style and be beyond criticism. But you talk to a certain demographic of very traditional Chinese sifu in Hong Kong, and they will tell you this with a straight face. And if you don't believe them, it's because, well, you're not Chinese and you just don't understand,
wow.
Right? And that's an issue. That's like a thing, right? So anyway, to come back to that, well, it's funny. We had so many questions. And it's interesting because we put a post for people to write questions. And now we have so many questions. We have like questions for the next 3-4 episodes.
Yeah.
And then you start asking me questions and like we've gotten to 2 so far, right? but that's okay. I mean, that is like, you know, an Ask Me Anything episode is like a box of chocolates, right?
Yes.
You never know what history of Hong Kong internal corruption you're going to get, right?
Yes.
It's like talk about kung fu, damn it. No, I don't chamber my leg like a Taekwondo person because it makes zero sense in Wing Chun. I don't use a bladed sidekick because it makes zero sense in Wing Chun. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I had a video camera. I didn't have a video camera. My dad had a video camera. And I set it up. Let me clarify that. And I had a couple Wing Chun books because even though I was learning non-classical Wing Chun, I didn't learn the forms, right? And so I wanted to teach myself the Siu Nam Tao form and the Cham Kyu form. So I had gotten Leung Ting's book and I taught myself the Siu Nam Tao form out of Leung Ting's book.
And so on video?
And I taught myself the Cham Kyu out of Leung Ting's book. But of course, I didn't know like the details about stance turning. I didn't know the details about like, you know, how, like all the, I mean, just think about
it's on video.
Yes. Just think about, I'll get to it. Just think about all the details that are in the Hun Sao. Just think about all the details that are in the turning, how you turn, how you shift, how you do all this stuff. I'm literally just looking at the book. And it's a book, so you don't know quite how you get from photo one to photo two.
Right.
So I taught myself this, and then I filmed it.
Sketchy.
I put the camera on like a table and turned the video camera on, and then I did it. Now, of course, at that time, I was a black belt taekwondo already, and now I'm learning a Wing Chun form. And in the Learn Ting Chum Kyu, you have the sidekick. I looked at the sidekick in the Chum Kyu book when Sifu Cheng Chun Fun performed it, and I didn't think from my taekwondo perspective, it didn't look very spectacular. Like, he's not really rotating the hip. He's, you know, because in taekwondo, you really turn the hip in the sidekick, and you're very long and everything like that. And I go, it just kind of looks like you're just kind of standing there and you just kind of throw your leg out to the side, right? It didn't look very spectacular. So I thought I'd improve it by using my taekwondo sidekick, right? And then so when I'm doing that form, I get to the part. The video's somewhere. I got to find it, but you guys will never see it. I mentioned the video, and this is testament to you not reading my Chum Kyu book, because I actually talked about this in my Chum Kyu book. I actually talked about how there's a video, and you guys will find Jimmy Hoffa before you'll ever find that video, right? And so I set up the sidekick, just like in the Lang Ting Chum Kyu. And then when I lift my leg, I fully pivot my hip out and do everything. I do like the classic taekwondo sidekick. And then I step and do the bong sao, right? And I thought like, yeah, see, I improved it because I know taekwondo, right? Only to start learning Wing Chun WT a few years later and realize like that way of doing a sidekick would literally never work within the framework of when we use the sidekick in Wing Chun, which is much closer. And it's only when your body happens to be bladed, which means your opponent turned you, which means you didn't choose to be sideways like you choose in taekwondo. Yeah. Because if I have a squared up position and you come towards, I use the front kick, I use the straight kick to the knee, to the hip, whatever. And I stop you with my heel, right? And I give you a strong, powerful kick that way. When do we have the side kick in Wing Chun? When we get turned sideways, when we get pushed sideways, when we have to move our hip because our leg gets blocked. So it means we don't just stand sideways and then do it, right? So actually the hip position, supporting foot position, and the general angle of the taekwondo kick, even if it's done lower, is completely contradictory to the aims of Wing Chun. And I say that as a taekwondo black belt, not as someone who doesn't understand taekwondo and I'm just trying to talk ish about it.
Yeah.
I literally learned taekwondo in the World Taekwondo Federation from Korean instructors who barely spoke a lick of English, all right? So my taekwondo I have a taekwondo pedigree, right? And the taekwondo sidekick literally does not work in Wing Chun. Also, the other problem is chambering the leg, all right? You know, because in Wing Chun, we lift the knee up almost like we're a marionette. The knee goes up in a straight line without the foot coming back, and then you launch the kick out, so it's short. Because if your opponent rushes you, you want to at least have your shin or your leg further ahead of you so that you have a shield between you and your opponent. If you chamber the sidekick in that classic taekwondo way and your opponent just rushes you, it's game over. So if the guy's trying to wrestle you, if the guy's trying to just get close to you and you chamber the leg like that, you have a problem. So the way Wing Chun does a sidekick, which may not look spectacular to the taekwondo eye, is completely contextualized for the way Wing Chun is done. So that's the reason why I don't mix it. That doesn't mean I still, like you guys know, I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I still kick the living crap out of you guys with taekwondo kicks when you guys get a little cocky thinking you're solid on kick defense. And I go, okay, come over here. Oh, you didn't close the gap, no. Right? So I still use it for teaching you guys that stuff, right? But within a Wing Chun framework, maybe there are other styles that have kicks that are more compatible with Wing Chun, but not taekwondo, in my opinion.
All right, next up we got Sifu Brian Jewell. You've probably touched on this before, but I'm curious. In your opinion, why do people judge a martial arts teacher's legitimacy on if they can or have fought in the past? This doesn't seem to happen in other sports, even boxing. Could it stem from a need to legitimize the practicality of traditional martial arts? Thanks.
That's actually a very interesting question, because Customato, who famously trained Mike Tyson, arguably one of the best heavyweights, not the best, but one of the best heavyweights, right? Customato boxed only a very little. He had an injury which prevented him from actually fighting. So he did not actually really fight in boxing, but he was probably one of the most brilliant minds in boxing and trained some of the best champions in the sport, not just Mike Tyson, but Floyd Patterson, a number of other boxers, right? And you'd be hard-pressed to have found anyone who had more knowledge of boxing than Customato in terms of the liabilities of different styles. And he essentially created his own style, the peekaboo style. And if you judged him using 2021 bro standards, well, this guy is a total loser instructor, right? Now, of course, we have to realize custom model was also an outlier, right? So it's like this. Someone who fought or had fighting experience could be a good instructor and could offer their insights to someone who is learning, but they could also be completely unable to communicate that, right? So we know that there are examples of people who are really good fighters and have a lot of experience who could not teach a math teacher how to do addition. Okay, I mean, like, just because someone is a good fighter, we all know that there are a lot of examples of fighters who are just horrible teachers. We have them in Wing Chun, you have them in every martial art. And there are examples of people who don't really have a crazy fighting pedigree, but they have a very analytical mind and they're extremely intelligent and they know how to teach other people how to fight. And they know how to adapt the art to different needs and so on and so forth. And then you have everything in between. So the problem with this kind of stuff is that it always creates dichotomous thinking. Either the instructor is a crazy fighter and therefore can then teach everyone how to fight, or the guy never fought before and therefore cannot teach you anything. And the problem is already in the question, all right? So why do we now have to have only these two categories when we know that in real life is a lot more about, you know, the different shades in between, all right? You have fighters who can't teach, and you have fighters who can teach. And you have people who don't know how to fight who can teach, and people who don't know how to fight who can't teach, okay? So the problem is that being in any one category does not necessarily mean that you are this or that, all right? You can't, in the same way that someone is a fighter, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can teach. Well, someone being a non-fighter doesn't necessarily mean that they are somehow the customato of their style. All right. So you have to look at these things on a case by case basis. Unfortunately, the general public, you don't have nuance. You don't have nuance in YouTube comments. You have groupthink and you have people piling on, and then you have people who are living in their own echo chambers. Right. So if people want to believe that the only person you can learn from is someone who has an 80 fight record and won all 80 fights, and if he lost one fight, well, why the hell would you want to learn from that guy? He lost the fight, right? If you have people who are at that extreme, I mean, what are you going to tell them about custom auto? What are you going to tell them about other instructors who maybe only had some fighting experience or maybe didn't really fight that much, but really understand? You know, one of the best jiu-jitsu coaches is John Donaher, all right, from Henzo's, right? And John Donaher was like Henzo's right-hand man. And he was in there and with the, you know, with all those killers there in New York for so many years. But John Donaher doesn't have like a decorated competition record. He never fought in UFC. All right. But he's, bar none, one of the best jiu-jitsu coaches that exist. The way custom motto is one of the best boxing coaches, right? And you have this in so many different fields. But unfortunately, the bros just want to be like, oh, yeah, he's best fighter or whatever. Like, look at Henner and Hiron. They had some sport jiu-jitsu tournaments when they were growing up and had some challenge fights back at the school or whatever, but neither one of them has competed in MMA, yet many MMA fighters go to them. All right? So, again, the problem is that the question is obviously nuance, but if people don't want to hear what that nuance is, then why would you waste any time arguing that? You know, if someone wants to, yeah, the only people to learn from are people who are fighters. If someone says that to me, even though I'm not that of that opinion, I go, yeah, man, you're totally right. Because, look, as you get older, everything is a cost-benefit analysis, all right? There's, like, this chucklehead in the comments who said, like, you know, the reason why I sometimes comment, thank you for commenting, it helps the algorithm, is because I say that when I don't have an elegant response to give someone, right? And it's like, and he's one of these guys who are like, clearly my existence, like I live in his head rent free because he always the comments stuff like that. And it's like, oh man, you poor soul. Can you imagine being so triggered by a YouTube channel that you don't even like that you have to go out of your way to like comment on? It's like, I can't, man, it's like, don't you have something to do or somewhere to go? Like, I don't understand. It's like, first of all, like, I don't have time to answer everyone, right? Yeah. And if I did, I would be spending more time doing that than doing what I actually earn a living with, which is teaching martial arts. So sometimes I write, thank you for commenting. And sometimes I write, thank you for commenting. It helps the algorithm if their comment is kind of nonsensical. And sometimes if it's like, oh God, for me to even try to correct all the fallacies in this argument, I'm going to be here for half an hour. So I write, thank you for commenting. It helps the algorithm, right? So sometimes I write because I don't have time, and sometimes I write about it because a proper response would just take too much time, right? But the thing is, it's a cost-benefit analysis. So when someone says, like, oh, the only people worth learning from are, like, real fighters, like, people assume, and this is, I think, part of the problem with discourse online. It's a problem with social media where someone posts something they disagree with and they get up in arms and they have to respond to it and say, well, let me tell you, and I'm going to put these five facts that you're not going to believe anyway. And after I write it, you know, you're totally going to have to think the way I think because now I just presented the logic to you, right? And people don't realize that, one, that never works out. What do most people do? They just double down on what they thought before, right? Or they discredit your viewpoint or whatever. So it's a cost-benefit analysis. So when some bro comes up to me, he's like, oh man, yeah, like, oh, the traditional martial arts don't really work, or you know, you gotta mix jiu-jitsu with this, that, whatever, for it to be blah, 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 or whatever. Or you can only learn from fighters or people who learn to fight or whatever. I go, yeah. Because look, how much time and effort is it going to take for me to lay out all the arguments against this person's opinion? And let's say I could change their mind in real time.
Okay.
Is that person then going to join my school afterwards?
Okay.
First of all, does that person even live in New York?
Yeah.
Does that person even want to do Wing Chun? Well, if the answer is no, then why would I even waste half a second talking about this, right? The problem is that people don't actually want to communicate with someone else. Like, tell me what your viewpoint is. I think the only martial artists you should learn from are fighters. Great. Tell me why you think that way. And then I'll let that person tell me his viewpoint. I learn what someone who has that viewpoint, what their line of thinking is. And I'm richer for the experience. Mm-hmm. And if that guy does not ask me what my opinion is or why I think differently, then why would I offer it?
Okay.
Because the problem with discourse, especially online, especially YouTube comments, is that no one is actually communicating back and forth. Everyone is delivering messages. And that is not communication. So the guy delivers his message. I believe Bruce Lee is not a fighter, blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's his message. He believes that. Am I having a face-to-face with this guy? No. Is this guy going to join my school after I convince him otherwise? No. Is this guy's non-belief in Bruce Lee as a fighter or whatever going to affect me in any way negatively? No. So why do I need to counter that? Like, what? Why do I need to take... One day I'm going to be dead, okay? And I guarantee you that 30 seconds before I die, the one thing I'm not going to be thinking of is, man, I should have answered BoboSauce86 on YouTube that one time when I could have just corrected his attitude about Bruce Lee. Like, you need to not give a crap. You need to... Who cares? There are words written in comments that people use their phone and gave half a second thought to, and people feel, oh, no, now I need to represent, all right? So in general, the dichotomous thinking and in general, the discourse online, who cares? You can maybe have a conversation in person. You can't have it online. Mm. And it's not worth it. I'm not, you know, people think that because I have opinions on certain things that I'm trying to convince everyone who's listening to my podcast that they have to follow those opinions. I'll tell you, and I absolutely love our podcast listeners.
Yeah.
But I absolutely don't care whether they agree with me or not on everything. Because you also should listen to things that you disagree with time to time.
Yeah.
It can also help you strengthen your own argument, or you might also learn something. All right? So that's how I look at that.
All right.
I think we got time for one more question.
Let's go into Minden. I've only recently discovered your podcast and really enjoy what you're doing.
Thank you.
Especially love any episodes where you talk about Bruce Lee.
Most people seem to prefer the Bruce Lee stuff.
Okay.
Especially when cocaine is involved.
Yes, of course. My question is, do you know for a fact of any Bruce Lee footage that exists that has yet to be released to the public?
Well, usually if things are not released, it's very difficult to know whether they exist or not, right? So I know that recently, like a couple years ago, we got treated to some new Bruce Lee footage that we didn't know before, right? That was Bruce Lee on that bicycle where he was on, I believe, on the lot of probably ABC Studios where he was shooting Green Hornet. And there was like this, somebody made some weird little documentary and Bruce comes out like in this funny handlebar bike and has right. a very brief conversation with this guy. And it's literally about a minute of Bruce Lee talking that we never saw before. And that was amazing. And I mean, like, as Bruce Lee fans, you know, if there was footage of him just sitting at a diner drinking a tea, you'd be like, oh man, did you see that footage of Bruce Lee drinking a tea, right? Because, right. of course, with someone who's passed away and someone who died so long ago, any little footage that we have is a big deal. Also, at Sharon Tate's funeral, you know, after the famous Manson murders, someone recently, like in the last couple of years, had released video footage from Sharon Tate's funeral, and Bruce Lee was at Sharon Tate's funeral, and there's a very brief moment where Bruce Lee kind of walks by and you see him and like he's probably on the screen for less than 2 seconds and people wow. are like, new Bruce Lee footage, right? So I'm sure that there might be a couple incidental gems where Bruce Lee's in, you know, somebody had an 8mm camera in Los Angeles in 1970 and he's filming his kids and Bruce Lee walked behind him, you know, accident, like there could be something like that, but of course that's just speculation. I cannot say who, but I know that someone has behind the scenes stuff from Enter the Dragon, and it's not Sammo Hung, who also has behind the scenes stuff but won't release it. I know of someone who has stuff from Enter the Dragon that's never been seen before, behind the scenes.
Roman Polanski probably got some behind the footage stuff.
I don't think so, because I think if Roman Polanski had done stuff with Bruce Lee, because I don't even think that there's a photo of them together, even though Bruce and Roman had traveled together on vacation and they knew each other obviously quite well.
It's my favorite director.
And Roman Polanski.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I don't know if I'd admit that.
Yeah, exactly. You and Woody Allen, right?
Yeah. I love Roman Polanski.
Yeah. And so, wow. you know, at some point, you know, Roman even bought Bruce Lee a new pair of glasses because he had suspected that he might have had something to do with the Tate murders. That's that story that Matt Pauly talked about. So, I mean, they definitely, and he had given Roman Polanski a certificate, I think, level 3 in Jeet Kune Do. But I don't think that they actually have a photo together. I feel that if Roman Polanski had footage of Bruce Lee, he probably would have done something with it or tried to monetize it somehow or whatever. So that's always the problem, because think about it. If you had footage, let's say, of Bruce Lee in the early 70s, maybe because of friendship or loyalty, you wouldn't want to bring it out there because you wouldn't want to feel like you were exploiting him. But 10 years go by, 20 years go by, and now it's not a matter of exploiting him, but it's a matter of sharing this beloved person with the rest of the world and perhaps even maybe monetizing it, right? So people might at first have not wanted to show it because they didn't want to feel like they were exploiting their late friend. But we're now talking 48 years after he died. So I think the statute of limitations on that has gone out. So I think that if people actually had stuff like that, that they were maybe apprehensive at first to release it, I still think by now they would have released it. So I'm not super confident that we're suddenly going to get an hour and a half of Bruce Lee in the backyard, you know, teaching Chee Sao to some Hong Kong celebrity in his Kowloon Tong mansion or something like that. But we don't know. I mean, it's quite possible. We've been surprised with things that have come out about Bruce Lee both recently and in the past, and footage and audio recordings from the Lam Khun Bak Toi that is on YouTube now and things like that. But maybe there's more stuff out there. I don't know.
What would be the freakiest footage you would dream to see of Bruce Lee? Something he's done, you know, he's done, but there's no footage of it, and you'd be like,
would either be his encounter with Lau Tai Chun, if there was a video footage of that, or his encounter with the guy who challenged him on the set of Enter the Dragon, or I mean, I wouldn't stop, you know, or maybe I would like to see the so-called I would like to see his meet, like Jackie Chan tells that story about how he met Bruce and they went bowling, and that was supposedly within 10 days of Bruce Lee dying. I would have loved to have seen that, because I would love, you know, to see again what Bruce Lee really looked like in those 10 days before he passed away, which would have been after his May 10th
Bruce
collapse.
Lee bowling.
Yeah. Well, he didn't actually bowl. He just kind of sat there and watched Jackie bowl. But this is 10 days or within a week or 6 days or so of his death. I'd be very curious to see what he looked like, because they're few photos of in the last 2 weeks of his life. Up to about 3 to 4 weeks before he passed away, there's still a regular amount of photos, but really those last 2 weeks is only a handful of photos. Mm. And he was really skinny and really gaunt. And I would like to actually see what he looked like at that time. Anyway, why don't we do one more quick question, because I don't really feel like ending on such a weird, somber note. Do you have anything even remotely upbeat?
I do.
Okay. It better not be another Dreisen question.
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing.
Yo, Dreisen, man. He's crafty. Fan7ANR, where does Wing Chun's power come from? In your opinion, experience. Is every strike supposed to have that 1-inch power? Or is it more like death by a thousand lashes? Hmm. Especially with chain punching.
Hmm. That's a great question. Well, that depends on the individual fighter, right? Because some people are born punchers and other people are not. And some people are born explosive power punchers, especially if they have a high distribution of fast twitch muscle fibers. And other people, if they have more of a distribution of slow twitch muscle fibers, they tend to be volume punchers. All right. So kind of classic example, like a Conor McGregor versus a Nate Diaz, right? Nate Diaz being more kind of slow twitch muscle fibers. He's the guy who can go for 5 rounds. He doesn't have like knockout power, but he can put it on and go and go and go. And other fighters are more like, you know, known for that touch of death, right? Because they have a lot of power. So the problem is that people always want these general answers to specific questions. And they want general answers to questions that, look, you have 10 Wing Chun practitioners. It's going to look differently for all of those. Because if you have someone who's smaller and not as powerful and not as explosive, then probably their Wing Chun needs to be more about learning how to close the gap and cling and frustrate the opponent's attempts to hit them back while they get their strikes in. Whereas if you have someone who's more athletic, bigger build, more explosive, that person's Wing Chun could focus more on, you know, sharp, fast, powerful punches. Everyone should try to improve the power of their punches, regardless of what body type they have, right? You should try to train both your ability to punch, like punches in bunches, your ability to punch with some volume over time. And volume punches over time are never going to be your most powerful punches, because you would get exhausted. If every single punch was a knockout blow, you're not doing a minute of chain punching, right? but you should train that like ability to just keep going, like to have a muscular endurance to be able to punch for a sustainable amount of time if those first few punches don't fail your opponent. But you should also train explosivity. You should also train for knockout power, within however your style chooses to do that. You should train both of those, but also understand that because of your body type, because of the type of opponent you have, you might not be able to implement one over the other. You might be more, I gotta go in with volume because that is what my muscle fiber distribution, my temperament, my body type tells me that I need to be able to do. And the other person gasses out really quickly because, like, for example, Tom, the bodybuilder, I would never tell him, are you going to try to drag someone into deep waters over the course of 3-4 minutes? Because he would most likely gas out because of his physique. He's got to really try to stop someone very fast, right?
Yeah.
So the problem is that this answer this is not a one and done kind of answer. You instructors have to cater this according to the student. You have to give the students a different option, show them how to punch powerfully and fast and explosively and try to, you know, that so-called one punch knockout, whether you get it or not. And you also have to have the ability to kind of punch for a longer amount of time. And then you have to figure out which one works better for you based on your body type and your temperament. So like I said, smaller people might have to learn to stick and smother more than be explosive because they might not have the firepower to do it. And more explosive people who don't have the muscular endurance or cardio to go into the long haul probably need to emphasize being extremely powerful very quickly, right? But again, that doesn't mean that the person who is not big or strong enough to knock someone out shouldn't still train that as a skill set, because it doesn't mean that there would never be that opportunity or that a lucky punch couldn't land. The same way that someone who is strong and explosive should also train long haul stuff as well, right? So it depends on the fighters. Now, to say, does every punch have an inch punch in it? This is a misunderstanding of inch punch. The inch punch is a demonstration of what is known as Cheongkyu fought, like long bridge power, your ability to generate power without first retracting your arm. But that doesn't mean that every punch you do is an inch punch. Otherwise, all Wing Chun fighters would have their arms mostly extended and they would just be doing these little mini punches all the time and going, inch punch, inch punch, inch punch. That's not it. All right? The inch punch demonstration, okay, is to show someone that unlike most traditional martial arts, we don't need to re-chamber the hand to generate a lot of power. But that doesn't mean that our hand doesn't retract to the second position when we punch. It just means that if my hand is out there and I have no time or no ability to pull it back for a second punch, I can still hit with enough power to, if I cannot knock you out, at least I can jolt you or knock you back, right? That's what the inch punch is a specific demonstration. Now, of course, we can, you know, you release all the power at the very end of the punch. So I understand when people say, oh, the inch punch is at the end of the punch, but they conflate the demonstration with the actual punching technique in Wing Chun all the time. And these are two things that are related, but they are not exactly the same. We are not inch punching our opponent into submission when we use our normal Wing Chun punches, right? So anyway, that was a very good question, though. I really enjoyed it. Cool. And that's all I got to say about that. All right, peeps. So what did you guys think about today's episode? Would you guys like me to do that deep dive into Hong Kong corruption, that ghost of Hong Kong? Or would you rather just me talk about Wing Chun? Let me know in the comments. And don't forget to write comments for me to answer on a future episode of The Kung Fu Genius. And remember, I don't pick them. The other guy does. And I'll see you guys next time. Word is I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpassed us. Your Kung Fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the... Lots of gems, lots of... inch punching. I'm gonna do the intro to show him how it's done.
I could do the intro to show him how it's done, and I've never done it before.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be going...
Going where, exactly? What?
Going where?
Yeah, you deserve a sad horn for that one.
You want me to do the intro?
No.
I'm going to do the intro.
No.
On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, The Kung Fu Genius is going to answer all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of inch punching, lots of no money, no water. Let's get to it. Jesus, Dre.
That's what a professional
My
looks
God.
Like.
You're supposed to.
Yeah.
Let's get to it.
So it goes like this. All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius is going to answer all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of inch punching, lots of no money, no water. Let's get to it. All right.
See?
Wow, you guys are good, man.